All right, everyone. Now I will pass it over to my colleague who has prepared an interesting feature program for you all. Let's take a look.
You definitely have a clear image of a concrete or a steel structure, but when it comes to tensile structures, you most likely cannot picture anything. They're self-standing structures, carrying only tension and no compression. Mostly made of membrane or industrial fabrics, they're most often used for roofs and canopies, creating unique private and public spaces. Mahout is the name of an Iranian company that makes all kinds of tensile structures. Tensile structures can cover vast areas. While they're lightweight compared to other types of construction, they're extremely strong. Tensile fabric structures are designed and engineered to withstand even the most severe weather conditions, providing protection from both rain and sun. Mahout says its products are made using the latest technology and high-quality materials, on par with their international peers. Mahout has under its belt a dedicated team of experts who are constantly exploring new trends and efficient designs for eye-catching yet resilient tensile structures. While the Iranian brand has a strong foothold in Iran's market and is eyeing higher horizons, Mahout says it's working to undertake international projects. Offering a unique landscape for outdoor eateries, restaurants, and coffee shops, tensile structures are beginning to attract more attention in the architecture industry. This means the future market will be lucrative for the actors in this field. And Mahout says it will stand out, as it believes quality is in the details.
There is so much more that can be said about knowledge-based products, so let's take a look at some news and trends in this field. You have probably heard the phrase NFT, or non-fungible tokens, being thrown around recently. The very first Iranian NFT issuance platform was established and launched in the country.
The platform is called Bita. It was created by a company in the field of developing digital technologies in the information communication technology sector. Bita digitally certifies artistic and non-artistic works in the form of non-fungible tokens. The developer says it plans to increase international access and grow the platform's ecosystem to determine accurate asset values. People can purchase NFT that are backed by authentic art approved by the system and sold at auction.
Most people don't think twice about fungi, but what if it could be used to help treat diseases? Well, an Iranian knowledge-based company has managed to come up with the technology to produce rare medicinal fungi.
This company focused on producing four species of medicinal fungi. Once cultivation conditions have been established, these plants can be mass-produced. Its medicinal properties will be used in the form of tablets and capsules. These fungi have the potential to treat liver disease, immune deficiencies, diabetes, and some skin diseases. Plus, the four species can now be cultivated in 3 months.
The number of cars and pollution increases as cities grow, and one way to manage this issue is to create specialized technology. Domestic knowledge-based companies and startups have developed 17 innovative products to improve road traffic and reduce air pollution.
The products were developed to address the rising number of vehicles and inner-city trips in cities nationwide. Some of these smart products are used to record traffic violations, collect traffic information, and license systems for restricted traffic zones, among many others. Smart traffic monitoring systems have also been developed by these companies.
We are fresh out of time for our program for today. Thank you for tuning in, and I will see you next time for another edition of Bazaar.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Prosecutors are among the most powerful players in the criminal justice system. They can send a defendant off to years in prison or even to death row. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times and published in the opinion section of the newspaper. The piece is titled, Who Will Hold Prosecutors Accountable? Prosecutors are among the most powerful players in the criminal justice system. They can send a defendant off to years in prison or even to death row. Most wield this power honorably. Yet when prosecutors don't, they rarely pay a price, even for repeated and egregious misconduct that puts innocent people behind bars. But why? Because they're protected by layers of silence and secrecy that are written into local, state, and federal policy, shielding them from any real accountability for wrongdoing. New York City offers a prime example of a problem endemic to the nation. Consider the city's official reaction to the barrel full of misconduct in Queens that a group of law professors recently brought to light. As the New York Times reported last month, the professors filed grievances against 21 prosecutors in the borough for everything from lying in open court to withholding key evidence from the defense, and then posted those grievances to a public website. These weren't close calls. In every instance, an appeals court had made a finding of prosecutorial misconduct. In many cases, the misconduct was so severe that it required overturning a guilty verdict and releasing someone from prison. Three men wrongfully convicted of a 1996 murder were exonerated after 24 years behind bars. But that rectified only the most glaring injustice. To date, none of the prosecutors have faced any public consequences. Some are still working. How did New York City respond to this litany of widespread misconduct by its own agents? It went after the professors who publicized it. In a letter to the committee that handles misconduct charges, New York City's top lawyer, known as the Corporation Counsel, accused the law professors of abusing the grievance process to promote a political agenda and of violating a state law that requires formal complaints about lawyers' conduct to be kept secret unless judicial authorities decide otherwise. And they virtually never do. The grievance committee agreed to punish the professors by denying them access to any future updates on their complaints, even though state law requires that complainants be kept informed throughout the process. The upshot is that the committee could dismiss the complaints tomorrow and no one would know. For good measure, the Corporation Counsel then sought to keep secret the letter requesting the law professors be punished for violating the secrecy law. This isn't just shooting the messenger, it's tossing the gun into the East River and threatening anyone who tries to fish it out. We know about all this because the law professors sued the city in federal court, claiming that the secrecy law infringes on the First Amendment. How could it not? If someone tells a New York Times reporter about a prosecutor's misconduct, the reporter is free to write a story addressing those allegations for all the world to see. But if the same person files a formal grievance about the same misconduct with the state, she is barred from talking about it. It's not even clear what the punishment for violating the law would be, as evidenced by the fact that dozens of prominent lawyers, including former New York judges and even prosecutors, went public with grievances they filed against Rudy Giuliani over his role in Donald Trump's efforts to subvert the 2020 presidential election and encourage the 6th of January riot at the Capitol. To date, none of these lawyers have faced public sanctions for speaking to the press. In theory, the secrecy law exists to protect lawyers from being smeared by frivolous complaints. But that rationale makes no sense when applied to prosecutors, who are public officials doing the state's work. In the Queen's cases, their misconduct is already a matter of public record. Even if it weren't, there is no principled reason to prevent the public airing of complaints, not to mention public hearings against officials who have the power to send people to prison. Certainly, the defendants they face off against in courts of law don't enjoy such privileges. New York shelters its lawyers from disciplinary measures more than most states in the country, even as it ranks near the top in total number of exonerations, a majority of which are the result of misconduct by prosecutors. Meanwhile, the few attempts to increase oversight of New York prosecutors have been stymied. A 2018 law established a commission specifically to deal with prosecutorial misconduct in a more independent and transparent way. But the State District Attorneys Association challenged it, and a court struck it down as unconstitutional. Lawmakers designed a new commission this year, but it appears that no commissioners have yet been appointed to it. New York's prosecutor protection racket is, alas, far from unique. In Washington, the U.S. Justice Department aggressively shields its own prosecutors from outside accountability thanks to a 1988 law that lets the agency essentially police itself. All other federal agencies and even parts of the U.S. Justice Department, like the FBI and the Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, are subject to oversight by independent inspectors general, who conduct thorough investigations and issue lengthy reports with their findings. Federal prosecutors skate by on an internal review process that is run out of the Office of Professional Responsibility, whose head is appointed by and reports directly to the Attorney General. The office almost never makes its findings public, and when it does, it often provides only a brief summary months after the fact. In the words of one legal ethics expert, it's a black hole. By contrast, the Inspector General's Office of the Justice Department just released its semi-annual report, as it is required to do by law, detailing the 52 reports it issued between April and September of this year, as well as the closing of investigations that resulted in 68 convictions or guilty pleas and 66 firings, resignations, or disciplinary actions. The level of scrutiny that federal prosecutors are subject to matters so much because they're just as prone to misconduct as their state and local counterparts. Take the botched prosecution of former Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska on corruption charges, or the legal green light Justice Department lawyers gave interrogators to torture terrorism suspects, or the more recent revelation that Jeffrey Epstein got a sweetheart deal in 2008 from his prosecutor Alex Acosta, who later became Labor Secretary in the Trump administration. Yet, in the latter two cases, the Office of Professional Responsibility found no misconduct. Alex Acosta was guilty only of poor judgment, the Office of Professional Responsibility said. In the Senator Ted Stevens case, the office found misconduct but said it was unintentional, and it let the prosecutors off with a slap on the wrist. Have there been other similarly egregious failures to hold prosecutors to account? Almost certainly, but we don't know because the U.S. Justice Department doesn't tell us. There is no principled reason for federal prosecutors to avoid the accountability expected of all public servants. Their exemption from the general rule was adopted in 1988 as a favor to Dick Thornburgh, who was then the Attorney General and had tried to derail the creation of an Inspector General for the U.S. Justice Department. Years later, Mr. Thornburgh admitted he had been wrong. This is a highly professional operation that goes where the evidence leads and is not directed by the way the political winds are blowing, he said at a gathering marking the law's 25th anniversary in 2014. I've come to be a true believer, he said. So have large numbers of Republicans and Democrats in Congress, a remarkable fact at the moment when the parties can't agree on the time of day. Their fix is straightforward. Eliminate the loophole in the 1988 law and empower the Inspector General to review claims against federal prosecutors, just as the office currently does in cases involving other Justice Department employees. A Senate bill co-sponsored by Mike Lee, Republican Senator of Utah, and Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, would do exactly this. Yet Attorney General Merrick Garland is continuing in the tradition of his predecessors by opposing any change to the existing system. Prosecutors can work in the interests of fairness and justice, but they can also cheat and destroy people's lives. They should be held accountable when they do that, both to vindicate their victims and to help ensure that they can't do it again.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Around a month ago, Israeli media reported that the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, has increased its drone activities in Israeli airspace. The drone operations were mainly for gathering intel. Last Friday, the Israeli military activated the Iron Dome and scrambled fighter jets, but failed to intercept a drone from Lebanon. As a result, air raid sirens were sounded in the north, and later it was announced that Israeli fighter jets were spotted flying low over Beirut. Hezbollah later released a statement saying the drone named Hassan entered Israeli airspace on a reconnaissance mission at a depth of 70 kilometers for around 40 minutes before returning untouched. This was the second incident in as many days and comes after Hezbollah's Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah said the group was making its own drones in Lebanon. Pointing to Israeli threats, the Hezbollah chief said the enemies only threaten others with war, but they know it will be very difficult and costly for them. He said Hezbollah is capable of upgrading the quality of its rockets to fend off Israeli threats. In fact, Hezbollah has been increasing its fleet of unmanned aerial vehicles, and now it is estimated to have some 2,000 UAVs. Based on Israeli media reports, Hezbollah is also in possession of over 100,000 rockets, and Israel's existing missile systems neither are capable of intercepting such a number of missiles and rockets, nor can protect Israeli settlers. The launch of the radio-controlled aircraft on Friday seems like a message from Hezbollah. Even if the Israeli military sometimes manages to shoot down Hezbollah's UAVs or drones, the resistance movement can keep sending them into Israel at will. If Israel believes it is free to violate Lebanese sovereignty with UAVs and fighter jets, Hezbollah will do the same south of the border.
It is interesting to see how fragile its entire military industrial complex actually is, and the latest event has just showed it once again that even though the Israeli regime is investing so many efforts in its so-called defense, it remains very weak, and it is the Lebanese resistance that continues to show the Israeli regime its own weakness.
Previously, retired Israeli General Yitzhak Brick warned that the Israeli military is not ready for any future war, especially a multi-front one. He predicted that in an extreme scenario, the resistance movements in Syria, Yemen, and Iraq, as well as Hamas in the Gaza Strip, will launch missiles and drones at Israel, so that the average number of rockets fired at the regime will reach 3,000 a day. Add to it reports during the Israel-Palestine conflict in May, when Israel's official military data indicated that the Iron Dome only destroyed fewer than half of the rockets and mortars fired by Hamas and Islamic Jihad resistance movements toward Israel. Therefore, in case of an all-out war, the Israeli regime would be vulnerable. While Tel Aviv sees its power waning, the resistance front has managed to increase its prowess. This is while Israel is trying to sell the Iron Dome missile system to Arab nations, but how can the Iron Dome work for them when it did not work for Israel?
This is why the entire existence of the so-called State of Israel in its current form necessitates the ongoing a killing of people and ongoing expansion of its military complex. But at the same time, of course, it remains fragile. This is a very existential contradiction within the Israeli colony that eventually will also probably lead to its to the fall of the apartheid regime and the Israeli hegemony, supposed hegemony in the region.
The editor-in-chief of Rayal Yom newspaper, Abdel Bari Atwan, says a small drone that is worth only $100 manages to penetrate into Israel's airspace, despite the Tel Aviv regime's costly military equipment and the Iron Dome system. He says Persian Gulf Arab states that are racing to buy this system from Israel should give it a second thought after the regime's failure against the Hezbollah resistance movement's drones. World leaders participated in the 58th Munich Security Conference in Germany, which is held annually. This year's conference was dominated by the Ukraine crisis, as major Western powers accused the Kremlin of zeroing in on an imminent invasion of Ukraine. In the conference, the U.S. Vice President, Kamala Harris, announced that Washington and its allies will impose significant and unprecedented economic costs on Russia if it further invades Ukraine.
We will impose far-reaching financial sanctions and export controls. We will target Russia's financial institutions and key industries.
Harris also added the U.S. will not stop with economic measures, but will further reinforce the eastern flank of NATO. Harris said some 6,000 additional service members are already deployed to Romania, Poland, and Germany. The official also noted that some 8,500 troops in the United States are on high alert. Also, another high-profile attendee in the 2022 Munich Security Conference, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, said Britain could block Russian companies from raising capital in London and has passed legislation to widen sanctions on Russian businesses and individuals if the country invades Ukraine. Johnson also stated that Russia would pay a heavy military price if it invaded Ukraine. Britain has already sent hundreds of troops to Poland to support NATO's eastern flank. However, the chairman of the Munich Security Conference, Wolfgang Eisinger, has highlighted the need for dialogue to resolve the differences. He said our world is in danger, traditional certainties are crumbling, threats and vulnerabilities are multiplying, and the rules-based order is increasingly under attack. He noted that the need for dialogue has never been greater. Meanwhile, Russia has time and again denied any intention to invade its western neighbor. It argues that it's deployed the military near Ukraine's borders to protect itself amid NATO's eastward expansion. Also, in a major step toward de-escalation, last week Moscow withdrew some of its troops near the Ukrainian border after completing military exercises. The U.S. President Joe Biden has ramped up his rhetoric against Russia amid mounting tension in Eastern Europe. He once again repeated his claim that Washington had intelligence showing his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, has made up his mind to invade Ukraine.
We have reason to believe the Russian forces are planning to and intend to attack Ukraine in the coming week, in the coming days. We believe that they will target Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, a city of 2.8 million innocent people.
Speaking at the White House, Biden warned that war will close the window for diplomacy with Moscow. Biden also said Western countries won't deploy troops in Ukraine, but will continue to bolster their defensive capabilities. Earlier, the White House said Washington and its allies are working on a sanctions package in case of a Russian invasion. This is while Italy says the bans should not target energy imports from Russia. This could throw the EU economy into mayhem or even negatively affect Russia's gas supplies to Europe. The EU is Russia's biggest trade partner. Nearly 38% of Russia's exports went to the EU, while over 36% of Russia's imports came from Europe. Russia is also the origin of 26% of EU's oil imports and 40% of EU's gas imports.
I don't think Russia cares so much and worries so much about Western sanctions, because Russia proved for the years, in spite of Western pressure and different sanctions, capable to sustain and even improving slowly, not so good as before, it's economy. So sanctions are not the main threat to Russia.
The U.S. accuses Russia of planning an attack on Ukraine, but Moscow says that is not true. Therefore, the latest warnings, based on unfounded accusations that a Russian invasion of Ukraine is just around the corner, would further complicate the situation at this critical time.
The Australian government announces a plan to blacklist the whole of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. The country had previously designated Hamas's military wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, back in 2003. Under the new restrictions, which will go into force in April, financing or providing any support to Hamas will be criminalized, with some offenses carrying a 25-year prison sentence. The reason for the blacklisting is what Canberra calls the group's, quote, hateful ideologies. But let's dive deeper and learn more about the Gaza-based group. Ever since Hamas scored a landslide victory in Gaza's parliamentary elections in 2006, it has been running the besieged enclave. Protecting the Strip has been one of the group's core responsibilities. Over the years, it has carried out the responsibility, the most recent instance of which came in May 2021, during the Israeli military's 11-day war on the Gaza Strip. The war killed some 250 Palestinians, including 66 children, but only 12 Israelis. If it weren't for the deterrent capabilities of the group, the number of Palestinian casualties would have been a lot higher. How would this justify branding the group as a terrorist organization? The case in point is that any group whose ideology goes against that of the U.S. and its allies is hit with such allegations. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem condemns Australia's decision to list the movement as a terrorist organization and calls on the Australian government to present an apology to the Palestinian people. He said the planned move attests to the biased support for the occupying regime and emboldens Israel to press ahead with its aggression against Palestinian people. The Islamic Jihad and the Popular Resistance Committees were also among Palestinian groups denouncing the decision. Voices of condemnation also came from inside Australia. The Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network, a national coalition of Australians who support Palestinian rights, disagreed with the designation, saying that it does nothing to advance the cause of peace and will only create more suffering for the 2 million people currently living under the 15-year Israeli blockade.
The word terrorist has been essentially coined and put into circulation by Zionists to demonize the people who are resisting their genocide in Palestine and the people all over the world who support that resistance. And in fact, the actual meaning of the word terrorism is deliberately targeting civilians to create fear or terror. And that is a military tactic that has been used since time immemorial by all sorts of different forces.
All in all, in the absence of any meaningful support for the people of Palestine and the condemnation of Tel Aviv, Israel continues to commit gross violations and gets away with murder.
The MKO terrorist group appears to be expanding its operations to include trafficking, among other criminal activities. An Albanian historian and journalist says the country's police have alerted the U.S. embassy that members of the terrorist organization are involved in various criminal activities in Europe, including human trafficking, with possible links to the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group. Alsi Jazeshi, citing Albanian media reports, says the MKO operatives, headed by the terrorist ringleader Mariam Rajavi and based in a camp near the capital Tirana, have attempted to traffic over 400 of the group's own members to France. Jazeshi added that a number of the terrorist cult's members have been detained for trafficking people from the Middle East to Europe, who were most likely Daesh terrorists. The journalist also says some senior MKO members, including the ringleader's sister-in-law, have been arrested while trying to traffic drugs into Italy, with police having prosecuted another member over theft charges. The Albanian police deny sending any letter to the American embassy without elaborating further. The journalist says the terror group has forced an Albanian media outlet to take down an article it published about the arrests.
They used Albania as a safe haven to carry out illegal activities and criminal acts. and now they are becoming a problem for Greece, Italy, Germany, and France. And when I say problem, not just trafficking human beings, drugs, money laundering, and some other activities. They have become a problem for Albania for the crimes I just mentioned, but also burglary, pickpocketing, harassing women, sexual harassment, and at least one case of rape.
Critics in Albania blame the United States and its Western allies for providing protection for the terrorist cult. Mujahideen Khalq Organization, MKO, also known as the MEK, is a notorious anti-Iran terror group that embraces an ideology that mixes Marxism and terrorism. MKO's crimes against Iran run the gamut from collaborating with Iraq's former dictator Saddam Hussein during the 1980 to 1988 war on Iran to a violent campaign of bombings across the country. One of the group's highest profile acts of terror came on June 28, 1981, when a powerful bomb went off at the headquarters of an Iranian political party, the Islamic Republican Party, where the party's leaders were holding a meeting. The bombing killed scores of Iranian officials, including the then head of Supreme Judicial Council, Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti. Most recently, Iran said there were traces of MKO involvement in the assassination of Iran's top scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh in November 2020. The anti-Iran organization has long been recognized as a terror group by much of the international community. However, in June 2008, the United Kingdom crossed the group off its terror list. The move was followed by the European Union in 2009 and the United States in 2012. Canada followed in the footsteps of the Western countries in delisting MKO as a terror group in December 2012 without offering any reason for the decision.
Some of them have their hands stained with blood. Some of them have battlefield experience. Some of them have some formal training by Mukhabarat, the special secret police of Saddam Hussein. So they are not just poor people trying to go to Europe to make a living. They are a danger. Criminals need to go to prison, not to roam in the streets of European cities. Absolutely. This is my idea.
Since removing their decade-long ban on the MKO, the Western nations, especially the United States, have used the group as a tool to pressure Iran. But the latest revelations about the terror organization can serve as a wake-up call for its Western supporters that the threats they have been brewing against Iran will backfire on them.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
American Islam has two branches. One is reactionary Islam and another is secular Islam. arrogance and materialistic powers have supported and continue to support both of these branches. Sometimes they create them, sometimes they guide them, and sometimes they help them. Original Islam is against these two branches. Original Islam is the kind of Islam that is comprehensive. It includes everything ranging from one's individual life to the formation of an Islamic government. Original Islam is the kind of Islam that determines how you and I should behave in the family, how we should behave in society, and how our behavior should be towards the Islamic government and towards the formation of the Islamic government. This is original Islam. These are a set of the principles to which we should be committed to. Another principle is that the people have a pivotal role. When we accompany this pivotal role of the people of Islam, the combination will be the Islamic Republic.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The Islamic Republic means that the people are the pivoting point. The goals belong to the people. Interests are people's property, and everything is in the hands of the people. Populism means the people's votes, demands, movements, actions, presence, and dignity in the Islamic Republic. This is one of the principles which we should believe in the real sense of the word. One of the fundamental principles and values is a belief in progress, change, perfection, and interaction with the surrounding environment. Of course, by avoiding the deviations and mistakes that might exist on this path. One of the principles is change and perfection. Our fiqh, our jurisprudence, our social knowledge, our humanities, our political and our different methods should improve on a daily basis. However, these components should be handled by skilled individuals, by experts, by those who are good at thinking, by those who have the qualifications to introduce new methods.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Ukraine crisis is entering a new phase as Russia recognizes the independence of two breakaway regions in eastern Ukraine.
I consider it necessary to make a long overdue decision to immediately recognize the independence and sovereignty of the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic.
Putin has also issued an order to deploy peacekeepers to Donetsk and Luhansk. Russia has already denied any plans to attack Ukraine or annex the two regions. The Russian president justified his decision by accusing the West of cheating Moscow and dishonoring their promise to stop NATO's eastward expansion.
They simply fooled us. We had five stages of NATO expansion, one after another. It has impacted very negatively on the nature of international relations and led to the loss of mutual trust.
Putin reiterated that Kyiv's admission to NATO would pose a major security threat to his country. The comments provoked Kyiv's reaction.
Ukraine unequivocally qualifies the recent actions of the Russian Federation as a violation of the sovereignty and territorial integrity of our state.
Hours later, the UN Security Council held an emergency meeting on the situation. Russia, Ukraine, and the U.S. clashed head-to-head at the meeting.
The internationally recognized borders of Ukraine have been and will remain unchangeable, regardless of any statements and actions by the Russian Federation.
What is more, this move by President Putin is clearly the basis for Russia's attempt to create a pretext for a further invasion of Ukraine.
We remain open to diplomacy for a diplomatic solution. However, allowing a new bloodbath in Donbass is something we do not intend to do.
Russia has warned Western powers to think twice and not worsen the situation, but the West's reaction was nothing other than critical remarks and threat of sanctions against Moscow. The Kremlin accuses Ukraine and the West of violating the Minsk agreements. It says the government in Kyiv is committing genocide in the Donbas region, while the West sends offensive weapons to the country. On the other hand, the West claims Russia intends to invade Ukraine. The Minsk agreements were signed in 2014 and 2015 to secure a ceasefire between the Ukrainian government and pro-Russian forces in the east of Ukraine. The Kremlin has repeatedly expressed concern about NATO's eastward expansion, demanding a ban on Ukraine's admission to the military alliance. So far, the U.S. and its NATO allies have only blown on calls by ignoring Russia's concerns and its requests for security guarantees.
People in the blockaded Gaza Strip staged a sit-in to support Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails and detention centers. During the sit-in, people shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and demanded the release of all Palestinian prisoners. Palestinian prisoners are political prisoners, and they are regarded as heroes and freedom fighters by all Palestinians.
The suffering of Palestinian prisoners has increased in recent months, especially following the bold escape operation in September. Prisoners, including women and children, suffer every day inside Zionist jails. The Zionist crimes against the prisoners must stop.
The sit-in comes at a time when hundreds of Palestinian detainees have been denied proper medical treatment in Israeli jails. Over 200 Palestinian detainees have died in Israeli prisons since 1967. During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Palestinian Ministry of Health condemned Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian prisoners, especially those suffering from chronic medical conditions.
For Palestinian inmates, Israeli prisons serve as gateways towards their death because of medical negligence. Currently, there are 700 very sick Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli prisons without proper medical care. Those sick prisoners are dying slowly as the world watches in silence.
Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers where they are denied basic human rights. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas demanded international protection for Palestinian prisoners.
We call on the Red Cross and all international organizations to help Palestinian prisoners, especially those who are sick in Zionist jails. We demand international protection for Palestinian prisoners. They are suffering because of the racist Zionist practices.
People here are calling on the international community to come out of its silence and help Palestinian prisoners.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, there are thousands of Palestinian prisoners suffering in Israeli prisons under inhumane detention conditions. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The third edition of the annual conference on Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, dubbed General Soleimani and New Islamic Civilization. The conference was held online this time, with 50 scholars and political pundits from across the world giving speeches.
General Qasem Soleimani is a martyr, and he died fighting the head choppers and the throat slitters. and a brave, a charismatic leader. And we all honor his life.
General Soleimani was the spearhead of the fight against terrorism and the guarantor of regional stability. Should Iran and Russia have sat on their hands and not defeated the terrorists in Syria and Iraq, they would have had to fight them in their own soils.
We know that the U.S. and some other countries used terrorism under the banner of religion to topple the Syrian government and move the battlefield to Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, and the entire region. But Soleimani shattered all the U.S.'s calculations.
Soleimani was the commander of IRGC's Quds Force, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations.
The security of the Zionist regime is an important issue for all of the American governments. What General Soleimani did was to put Palestine in top of the Muslim world's priorities. And then he gathered and united all of the groups that opposed Israeli occupation as the resistance axis. This was the major motive for the U.S. to assassinate him.
Iran and Iraq have set up joint investigation committee on General Soleimani's assassination. Based on the latest findings of the legal team, 120 people have been identified in connection with Soleimani's assassination. Former U.S. President Donald Trump tops the list.
Iranian and Iraqi judicial teams are seriously following up on a legal pursuit to bring the culprits to justice. Iraq is where the assassination took place and has so far kept close cooperation with Iran. In the four-day conference, we're also going to discuss legal dimensions of Soleimani's assassination.
General Soleimani holds a reputation for eliminating Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. He also led major operations in Syria that led to the recapturing of key areas from Daesh. That's why his assassination is viewed as a huge loss for the region and a big win for the terrorists.
General Soleimani's assassination gave a clear clue about who is who in the fight against terrorism in the region. The United States killed the nemesis of Daesh, and that puts Washington on the terrorists' team. This as Iran is firmly following up on its legal pursuit to bring the perpetrators to justice, saying this is to make sure that such incidents will not happen again against Iranian military figures. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Cleaning up the mess left behind by Storm Eunice that battered the UK this week. With record speeds of nearly 200 kilometers per hour, much of the country from Scotland to England felt the force of the storm's temper. Footage posted to social media showed trees fall, history be realigned, railway travel disrupted, planes struggling to land, iconic landmarks damaged. The capital, London, issued its first ever rat severe weather warning. Here, too, authorities asked residents not to leave home.
So the message to Londoners is, whilst the Met Office has the red weather warning, stay indoors. A storm Eunice is the worst storm we've faced in 3 decades. It's really important we don't inadvertently put ourselves in harm's way by being outdoors.
Many heeded the warning and stayed home. Others did not. 3 people were killed.
One of those killed, a woman in her 30s, traveling in a car with a man of the same age here in North London when this tree fell onto their vehicle, killing her, but sparing her partner.
Eunice knocked out electricity for tens of thousands of households on its path. The government had already been warned that the UK lacks the resilience to deal with storms, particularly in terms of electricity infrastructure. Here in London, there is a sense of worry about what's to come next.
I guess you're just not really used to it happening, and I guess it's just one of those things that's going to happen more often, and we need to do more to be prepared to deal with them.
I'd say it's quite concerning because it kind of makes me think of the bigger picture of where the entire climate is headed, where we're headed as a species. Everything was just in disarray. It was crazy and chaotic, and I know a lot of people felt scared.
Eunice was predicted to be the first storm in 30 years and certainly won't be the last. The clear-up phase is well underway now, but the wider debate about the state of the UK's resilience against storms is only just gathering pace. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Oh.
On Friday, school pupils held protests in over 40 cities across Italy demanding the government to put an end to obligatory work placements in the last 3 years of school. The demonstrations were staged after a student, 16-year-old Giuseppe Lenoci, died in a road accident on Monday while he was on board a truck for a school work internship. Last month, another student, 18-year-old Lorenzo Perrelli, was crushed to death by a steel girder of 150 kilos while working in an internship for a private company.
È una vergogna.
They should be ashamed. School principals should be reported to the authorities for striking deals with private companies without being provided assurances on working conditions in factories. They have been reckless and should be punished.
Lavoro non pagato, praticamente sfruttamento.
School work internship is equivalent to unpaid work. It is just another form of exploitation. In most cases, it doesn't give anything to students. It only helps companies make more profit.
About 3,000 students gathered in central Rome demanding the government to remove the education minister and scrap obligatory work experience programs for high school students introduced by former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi in 2015. In Turin, tension and anger went out of control when a group of students tried to break into the local headquarters of industrial employers group Confindustria and were repelled by police with some batons being wielded, with at least 7 officers being hurt.
Ci sentiamo anche di scendere in piazza.
We are staging protests also to raise awareness over our living conditions as young adults. Our generation is suffering greatly also from the anti-COVID measures, which restricts our freedom to move, to interact socially. We are left alone with our phones following school lessons online, with our psychological scars, and the government is not doing anything to help us.
School dropout levels in Italy are among the highest in the EU, and due to the pandemic, with the government quickly deciding to make all learning remote. Also, the cases of social withdrawal and self-harm among young people are on the rise. Healthcare professionals are warning. In the past 2 years, and especially in recent months, Italy has been the scene of protests across the country. Rallies have been held against deteriorating living conditions, mandatory vaccination and health passes, as well as what the protesters describe as the government's mismanagement of the COVID pandemic. Max Civili, Rome.
Dozens of Nigerian Muslims, mostly supporters of prominent cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, demonstrated in Abuja to condemn Saudi Arabia for the war on Yemen and its continued blockade of the impoverished country. They said the bombing of civilian targets by the Saudi-led coalition and its siege on Yemen has caused a serious humanitarian situation there.
A coalition of Saudi Kingdom and that of United Arab Emirates, we are launching a strike on the innocent people of Yemen. They have been killing a lot of women, children, men, and everywhere, at their houses, at their business places, hospitals, schools, everywhere. Nowhere is safe in Yemen. They are killing, and the world is silent.
The Saudi war has escalated recently as Riyadh has intensified its aerial and ground attacks, worsening the humanitarian situation in Yemen. The protesters said the ultimate goal of Saudi Arabia is to reinstate the former Yemeni president.
They want to return Mr. Hadi back to power. You can't return somebody back to power with killing those people you want him to come and rule. You are killing them and you want him back to come and do what? What is he coming back to do? To come and rule who? Innocent people or dead bodies?
The protesters said human feeling should prevail over the intrigues of the power struggle on the situation in Yemen. They added that the senseless shelling of innocent civilians in Yemen must stop, while the international community has a moral responsibility to put a stop to the carnage. Danjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
A new report, an assessment of the British government's widely criticized multi-million-dollar-a-year counter-extremism strategy known as PREVENT, first introduced after the 2005 London bombings.
The People's Review of PREVENT essentially puts forward the voices of those who have been impacted by PREVENT, as opposed to the government review, which is speaking primarily to people who are in receipt of Prevent funding and essentially have a vested interest in having more Prevent.
Millions of those funds are being injected into areas with 73% Muslim populations, codenamed PPAs, Prevent Priority Areas. The British government dismisses all criticism of its strategy and claims Prevent is a vital part of their counter.